You're listening to an edited version of the live Voices of Montana statewide radio program. Find us on Facebook and subscribe for further podcasts wherever you get your audio on demand. I'm Tom Schultz, host of the program. Thanks for joining us, and please feel free to contact me at studio@voicesofmontana.com.
I think we ought to have a little fun every now and again, don't you? Would a cowboy poetry gathering be a little bit of fun? I think it would. So we're going to go over to Lewistown today and check on the 36th annual Montana Poetry Gathering. I'm excited about that. And then there is an issue, and it's been an ongoing issue about water in the Columbia River Basin, and it involves electricity, it involves the environment, and we're going to get into that a little bit today, too. So thank you for joining us as we approach the weekend. It is from Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana.
It's time for the fastest hour in radio, from Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana with Tom Schultz. Call in today at 866-627-5483 or text a comment or question to 781-627-5483. Now here's your host, Tom Schultz.
Thank you so much, Tom Schultz. Yes, and today, fire update maybe. I'm trying to work on that and see if we can't get somebody to talk about it. Really blew up the fires in eastern Montana in particular. There are evacuations. Boy, hang in there, you guys. Just keep hanging in there. I feel like August has kind of cooled down a little bit, so I'm getting some hope from that, I guess. But that's something to talk about here today, too. And then the Montana Poetry Gathering and Western Music Rendezvous. It really is a big thing. I mean, I think the hotels are sold out in the Lewistown area. Well, this will be going on, and I kind of want to go. I don't know. There'd be something about it, right? All the tradition there. And then the Montana cowboy poetry. I've read some of that. I've kind of been around it a little bit. And it's. I think you can relate to it in a lot of ways. But a lot of performances going on there as well. And as I said, too, 36th annual. We're going to get into that with a gentleman named Bill Garcia. I think, Bill, it's fair to say, good morning, Bill. How you doing, by the way?
I'm fine, Tom. How are you?
Hanging in there. It's fair to say that you are a Hawaiian cowboy in Montana, but you've been secretary of this organization, the Montana Cowboy Poetry Gathering and Western Music Rendezvous, for years, as well as a board member, and you've seen one of these. Thank you for being here. Appreciate that. Was that fair to say? How do I describe Bill Garcia? Well, he's a Hawaiian cowboy living in Montana right now.
That is exactly correct.
Okay.
From the age of from the age of nine, I wanted to come to Montana. I used to watch TV with Lawrence Welk Show and all of those things back in the day, and they used to advertise Montana. What was it? Ponderosa Pines used to advertise 40 acres for $400, and I said to myself, I want to go there, because I knew that I knew what would come if I stayed in Hawaii, and what I knew would come came, so I just had to take care of family business. But in 2015, we finally got to Montana after all of the years that I've wanted to come. And I brought my growing up and the things I learned as a Hawaiian cowboy growing up with my uncle and aunt on their cattle ranch. My uncle was Hawaiian, and he was a heck of a horseman and cattleman, and I got to ride with some very, very astute cowboys from the age of six. And it's just wonderful.
You should tell that.
Go ahead
and tell the story about, your upbringing in Hawaii, but also the history of the cattle industry in Hawaii. I think that's interesting.
Okay. Most people don't realize this, but cattle were first introduced into Hawaii in 1793. England was trying to court the Hawaiian kingdom and become a partner with them. Now, whether that was for a takeover or not, I have no idea. But in any event, in 1793, George Vancouver, a British sea captain, stopped in Monterey, California, and picked up about 10 head of cattle and gave them as a gift to King Kamehameha with the edict, if you will, don't let anybody touch them for 10 years. So that was an edict that came from King Kamehameha I. Well, after 10 years, the cattle were in a put in a 400-acre pasture, stone-fenced pasture, and they procreated and broke the fences and became wild. In 1805, horses were introduced into Hawaii. And the Hawaiians had never seen a horse before, and they called them Ilio. Leo. Leo in Hawaiian is the derivative of what the Hawaiians called a big horse, because dogs were called Ilio. So anyway, King Kamehameha III, Kamehameha's son, Kamehameha the first son, was familiar with the what was going on in Mexican California at the time and had seen the vaqueros work. And he brought in the four vaqueros from Mexican California to teach the Hawaiians what to do with the cattle and horses and everything. And they became pretty prolific at it after a time. And how the word paniolo, that's the Hawaiian word for cowboy, that paniolo is a derivative of the Spanish español. The legend goes that the Hawaiian cowboys were sitting around a campfire with the Mexican cowboys, and the Hawaiians asked, "So, who are you?" And they said, "Oh, we're Espanol." Well, there's no S in the Hawaiian alphabet, so that they said, "Well, that makes us Paniolo, Paniola," and that's how it came about.
Bill Garcia is with us here, as I mentioned, a storyteller and a performer from Montana. But as we're talking about this 36th Montana Cowboy Poetry Gathering, I appreciate that, you know, that history. It seems like, Bill, as I talked with you yesterday, too, Hawaii turned out to be real cowboy country with the kind of not for everybody, but there was a serious cattle industry in Hawaii through many years and remains today. So let's talk about this 36th Montana Cowboy Poetry Gathering. You've been going to a few of these. I guess I got to ask, what's a cowboy poetry gathering like?
It is really a neat affair. The first time I ever went to one was 2013. And they had performers that came from all over, Florida, Georgia, California, Nevada, Wyoming, all over the country. And each brought with them a taste of and a flavor of what their experiences were in the cowboy industry. And then you have poets who put to poem what they're feeling about how they grew up and everything. And it was absolutely wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I fell in love with it, and I've been a part of it since 2013.
Talk about some of the characters then that you know and that you have met and still stay in touch with through the many years of this gathering.
Well, one of them in particular is Dave Stamey. I'm sure you folks have heard of him because he is a heck of a musician and songwriter. And in the Western venue of music, he has won numerous and numerous awards. And I met him in 2013. I was not a part of the activities then. I hadn't signed up for it. I didn't realize I would be able to get up there, but I finally did. And Dave approached one of the performers that I was talking with, and Dave said, "So I hear you're from Hawaii." I said, "Yes, I am." He says, "My wife and I spend every other vacation there." He says, "You got to play an instrument coming from Hawaii." I said, "I do." And he had me get it out, and I sang him a few songs, and lo and behold, I was asked to perform with Dave and Vic Jensen on their little get-together, and that started the whole ball for me.
Nice. So do you play the ukulele? Come on, you do, right?
I play the ukulele, I play the guitar, I play the piano.
Do you have a ukulele handy?
I have my guitar handy.
Okay. Bill Garcia with us. I might have, I don't know, could you pick one for us real quick?
I'll tell you what, I can sing a short song for you. This is called The Owl's Lullaby. Now, in Hawaii, there aren't a whole host of songs that refer specifically to cowboys, performing. There are some, and there is one that is in particular, it's called Wyomina, Wyoming, translated in the English language. In 1908, three paniolo from Hawaii entered the Cheyenne Frontier Days steer roping. At that time, they called it the World Championship. And these Hawaiians were not given a snowflake's chance in hell of doing anything there, because after all, they were up against the world champions of that time. Well, lo and behold, when it was all over, Ikua Purdy took first place, beating the number two guy by 56 seconds. And in third place was Archie Kaawa, and in sixth place was Jack Lowe. 100 years later, in 2008, Cheyenne Frontier Days commemorates that whole affair, and a whole bunch of us from Hawaii got up through the Paniola Preservation Society and put on performances there and saddle-making booths and all of that kind of stuff for them, and that was absolutely wonderful. And people on the mainland here finally began to see, wow, there is something about the cowboy in Hawaii.
And it's called Owl's Lullaby?
Yes, it is. This is an old song, and
we have 3 minutes before we'll go to break. If we can't get it in, we'll come on back.
Okay. You want me to wait till break, or you want me to sing? I don't think it might take more than 3 minutes.
All right, then. Let's do it after the break, okay?
You got it.
Yeah. But a few more questions here, then, about this this gathering of it. It's a Western music rendezvous as well. And you yourself, there's a lot of focus here on Western music and performance, and they've got Red Steagall. Do you know Red?
I've met Red, yes. I don't know him very well, but I did meet him, and he is an outstanding performer in my book. I saw him first in Hawaii in the late 90s, and I fell in love with his poems. I fell in love with his songs. I fell in love with the fact that he is a cowboy. And when you know somebody's for real, you kind of gravitate to him, and I'll tell you what, Red's for real.
I believe that 100%. Would he let you play ukulele on one of his songs?
I don't know if he would or not, but
I'll ask him.
If he asks me, I might.
Yeah, I'll ask him for you. Just give me his phone number. A little bit. We got like about a minute and a half. Tell us about this rendezvous, then. I suppose you're going to feed people. I suppose there's going to be something to drink or something for the kids.
I'll tell you what. Tonight, we have the barbecue, which is for the performers and guests and things like that. And there are still tickets available. This dinner is going to be held at the golf course up here in Lewistown. And there are tickets available for $25. So get a hold of Karen Kuhlman, and you can get those tickets.
What else? Is there a parade? Tell me more about the gathering. You guys,
no parade.
Okay, shoot.
No parade. You show up at Fergus High School Friday morning, and there are various locations where performers, singers, poets get to perform and do their thing. And it starts about 9 o'clock in the morning and ends about 4:30 in the afternoon.
It doesn't end at 4:30 in the afternoon, I'll tell you that. That's my humorous little take on that.
I'll tell you what, it really doesn't, because then on Friday night there is this jam and dance over at the golf course again, and the guys get up and perform, and people dance, and it's a heck of a nice time.
I bet. Yep, that sounds like a good old Montana time.
I'll tell you what, you know, it's amazing how similar this type of lifestyle is across the country. And I've met cowboys and cowgirls.
All right, stand by, please. Stand by. In fact, get your guitar out there, will you, Bill? Get the gear ready. We'll come on back after the break and hear Owl's Lullaby from Bill Garcia in just a bit. Just a little bit. We're going to catch up on a story that's been developing over the years, and a little bit of new information on it in terms of Oregon, the state of Oregon, seeking more spill or more water over the dams, and it just causes a lot of problems. We'll discuss that with a letter from the Montana Electric Cooperatives to the state of Oregon regarding this. So back with the more Voices of Montana, Tom Schultz alongside Joe Lucas is going to join us a little bit later on for that story. We're back at the Montana Cowboy Poetry Gathering and Western Music Rendezvous, 36th annual. And it's one of those fun old times, I think. Bill Garcia has been going there for a while. He is secretary of that committee, that organization. And it is officially long-winded Montana Cowboy Poetry Gathering and Western Music Rendezvous. Hawaiian Cowboy with Bill. Any more setup for this Owl's Lullaby, or you're just going to hit it for us?
I'll just hit it for you.
All righty.
Who will talk to me? Who will answer me? Who knows why I sing? Who knows the reason why I sing this lullaby? The owls are flying, I hear them all sighing through the trees and the curtains as they hurry on home. With my feet on a limb and my eyes sad and lonely, I sing who will talk to me? Who will answer me? Who knows why I sing? Who knows the reason why I sing this lullaby?
Owl's Lullaby. I get it now. That was really good. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's fine.
You know, if I may digress just a second, this I like this song because when I was a kid growing up with my uncle and aunt on their ranch, the pheasants and the owls, barn owls, used to get you when you get up in the morning. They'd all be sitting on the fence posts, and you would hear the owls talking themselves with the whoo whoo whoo, you know, and when I heard this song as a kid growing up, I said, this is a song that I'm going to put in my repertoire because it reminds me of the good old days.
Yeah, and that's quite an appeal, actually. So that song has been around for how long?
Oh, this song was written back in the 1890s.
Would you say that's a traditional Hawaiian song?
It actually isn't a Hawaiian song, but there was a Hawaiian cowboy that took this under his wing. He became a storyteller, and he always finished everything that he did with this particular song. And over the course of time, it became something that all of us cowboys kind of fell to and liked and began to take up, and it's become tradition ever since.
And as has the Montana Cowboy Poetry Gathering, a pretty big tradition when you look at it's award-winning, recognized by many different organizations. You get 1,000, 2,000 people attending all those various activities. Pretty cool, Bill. What's your main excitement about this one with the Cowboy Poetry Gathering? I think last year you had to cancel it, right? And so
Yeah, because of COVID, it was put off. And this year, thank God, we have been able to put this thing together. The unfortunate part is that we have a lot of Canadian friends that come down, but that has been curtailed because of the closure of the border to non-essentials coming over. So for the most part, Canadians will not be here this year, and they have always been a staple.
Yeah, it's too bad. But Canadians are real cowboys.
Oh, hell, yes. Yes. You know, I tell you what, Tom, across America, there are cowboys all over the place.
Yes.
And I had the pleasure of, I did some team roping in California when I was in graduate school. I didn't actually work on ranches there, but I've had the opportunity to cowboy in Kansas with some really top-notch guys, and obviously here in Montana. And the guys in Kansas told me when they saw me at working, they said, wow, you guys in Hawaii do it just like us. I said, yeah, pretty much the same wherever you go.
If you're doing it right, yep, Yep. Hey, Bill, thanks, man. I appreciate it. The gathering is in various places. As you mentioned, the high school is one of them, but across Lewistown, that's in central Montana. I know folks have come from a long ways. I am sorry about missing our Canadian friends, but give them all a high five. Would that be welcome? Give them all a high five for us, okay, Bill?
I will do that, Tom, and I want to thank you for having me on and talking about the Montana Cowboy Poetry Gathering, because I'll tell you, it is really a neat deal.
It was a it's a hoot. It's got to be a hoot. I know. I want to get there one of these days because I always like to take part in a hoot. We'll take a break and come on back, and Joe Lucas is going to join us as we switch over to an issue regarding water and power and conservation. That affects Montana. Energy, it's huge. Joe Lucas will join us after this from Brian Bennett. All right, quickly switching gears here, and it is a bit of a switch, but this is something that we should talk about. It's been going on for a while. If you've been here a little bit, you understand there is always conflict over water and resources. I shouldn't say always. That's the wrong way to couch that. But there is something, there's always involvement when it comes to energy and water and resources for Montana in the Inland Northwest. Joe Lucas now joins us, and he is, let me go back over here. Yep, my screen's working now. Joe, thank you. The general manager of the Western Montana Generation and Transmission Cooperative. And let's set this up regarding this letter that you guys wrote to encourage the state of Oregon to pull back on their efforts for more spill.
Yes. Good morning. Yeah. What we're faced with here is the ongoing saga of decades of litigation where those concerned about salmon in the Northwest and the Columbia River system have kind of unfairly, you know, painted the Columbia River Power System as the sole responsible entity, and have continued to sue in federal district court, asking a judge to basically take over operation of the river system, which reduces the amount of water available for power, increases the risk of blackouts, and just overall creates a very difficult situation when you've got the potential for a federal district court judge to operate the river.
And so you guys wrote a letter. Give us the nature of that letter, the encouragement to the state.
Well, the letter that was signed by some 70 plus utility leaders across the Northwest seeks to identify this for what it is. It's a leveraging strategy from the state of Oregon and others to use this request and to basically use the federal district court to leverage the hydro system by devaluing it, thereby, you know, making their preferred option, which they can't get through district court, that is dam breaching of the four lower Snake River dams, to try to make that look more attractive to electeds by playing this leveraging game and attempting to devalue the federal hydro system.
How much do they have in their holster when it comes to being able to defend their position?
Well, they make these arguments about, you know, impacts of the dams on salmon survival, but there's so much research out there that shows that this is not a hydro system problem. This is a Pacific Coast wide problem. We see Chinook runs declining up and down the Pacific Coast from California to Alaska, and it's been shown that rivers without dams have the same problems. So they're kind of recycling the same tired arguments about how, you know, the hydro system impacts salmon survival, yet we spent over $18 billion to recover these fish, and we've done about everything we can do on the hydro system. And so they can't get the federal district court to order, they don't have the authority to order dam breaching. So you're basically left in this leveraging game.
Let's see. Not enough. Stand by, Joe, because we got a breakup coming, and I think there's more into this story that we have to talk about. The possible solutions on the other side of the conflict that's in front right now, because it seems like it has moved along. Some history about the long-term effort to remove dams on the Snake River, and more ahead here on Voices of Montana.
Voices of Montana continues right after this.
You're listening to a podcast from the live Voices of Montana radio show. Be sure to check out the full podcast page at voicesofmontana.com for a full listing of all our programs. We've been covering Montana issues for more than 20 years. Thanks for listening today.
Here we are talking water in the middle of this severe drought, almost every county in Montana, fires in a lot of places. We talked yesterday about the one. It had grown so fast, the Rich Springs fire. Richard Springs fire. Let's see, what is it at? Now, they had winds yesterday up to about 25 miles an hour, burned through 150,000 acres now, and then some. And Richard Springs fire, Northern Cheyenne and Rosebud County residents have been evacuated. Many of them, I think they're even up to about a couple of hundred. Situation going on there. So our thoughts and prayers and everybody being safe. I guess it just, we can talk about it because there's so much of this activity going on. We need to remind ourselves. Joe Lucas. Okay, back with Joe. Joe, thank you for being here. Joe, again, with the Western Montana Generation and Transmission Cooperative. He's the general manager there as we're talking about more spill being potentially ordered, or Oregon, across the dams for salmon protection. There's some information he relayed on salmon protection there, as well as it's sort of a leveraging strategy because they've been trying. Environmental communities believe that the salmon are going to fare better, and the fish are going to fare better without the dams. I don't think they're taking into account the economic cost of that versus what they're going to get in return, because they've been working a long time on ways to improve spawning and migration upstream. And they've had some success, but it's never enough. Joe, back again, and thanks again for being here. You guys wrote this letter. Give us the nature of this letter, move forward, because you guys have been, I think, are you more united now than ever in trying to get some resolution on this long-term environmental conflict over the water and the fish?
Yes, it's a long simmering debate, and for far too long, the focus has been, squarely upon the federal dams. We strongly believe we need a comprehensive solution to the problem that addresses, not just the hydro system, addresses, hatcheries, habitat issues, ocean conditions, very importantly, harvest. It makes no sense whatsoever to us to catch and eat an endangered species. So we've got this, focus on spill on the hydro system and the other, extremely concerning development here. And we saw it, as you talked about, fire and drought. We've seen it with, in Spokane, we did have, blackouts, rolling blackouts this summer. We narrowly avoided blackouts in the Tri-Cities area of the Northwest. It could hit us here in Montana. And one of the only things standing in the way of severe, blackouts in the Northwest is the federal hydro system. So this increased spill could bring that into play in a very dangerous fashion.
Okay, you've given some examples out there and some figures, and they're kind of broad. Define that a little. What's it look like then? What are they looking for in terms of increased spill? How much electricity are we going to be short in the overall grid, if you've got that number in front of you, or any kind of example about what the spill will do specifically, if that's allowed?
Yeah, one of the things they're looking for is to increase the spill from 16 hours a day, which gives some flexibility to the power operation, to making that 24 hours per day. They're looking to, draw down the reservoirs in the lower Columbia to within, only a 1 foot operating range. Some of these reservoirs can move up to 10 feet, which is how you get your flexible power output. They're talking about expanding the still from just during the juvenile salmon out migration from basically April through August into across winter. And here in Montana, winter is our most critical time when we get our, 30, 40 below cold snaps. If you're still in water in the winter, when you need that power, it becomes you know, very, very dangerous. So the, you know, the amount of power will fluctuate based on river flow, but we're potentially talking about, you know, over a thousand megawatts of generation impact from something of this magnitude. And we're already doing a lot of spill and a lot of lost power generation for salmon migration.
Yeah.
So this is a very troubling development.
Well said. I mean, especially in terms of how much it would potentially cost to remove all these dams, continuing that into the loss of the economy and energy, security and things like that, versus what they believe might be achieved. And as you said, rivers without dams have the same problem when it comes to Chinook runs, or at least that's part of what the research has shown. Columbia Basin Collaborative, this, again, an ongoing problem here, and this commission, this collaborative was created not that long ago, Joe, and do you think it's had a chance to do its work yet? What does the collaborative have to say about this decision, and what is the collaborative?
So the Columbia Basin Collaborative is an offshoot of a large multi-party effort to identify salmon and steelhead recovery targets, quantitative goals for recovery. You know, we've largely focused on, you know, a handful of ESA listed runs without, you know, taking a comprehensive look. So that was a multi-year effort to develop these quantitative goals. The offshoot of this is this Columbia Basin Collaborative, which is basically, what do you do to get there? How do you meet these goals? Well, this effort hasn't yet started. And, you know, the state of Oregon is purported to be supportive of it as they, you know, run off to the federal district courthouse, you know, seeking this, mm-hmm. this, you know, expanded attack on the federal Columbia River hydro system. So we really haven't even got started with these discussions about what can you do across the life cycle to meet these recovery goals. And now all those resources and energy is diverted into this ongoing litigation. So it's, you know, very, very frustrating, and it's really, we believe as utilities that, you know, we need to look across the life cycle, not just at the hydro system. We've done so much and we've spent so much time, energy and money, so much lost power, and it's just highly unlikely that whatever tiny increment is left will move towards recovery in any meaningful fashion.
And that's the kind of thing that makes sense if other people are sharing that conclusion. It makes perfect sense if people are sharing that conclusion. What groups share that conclusion?
Well, it's really hard to say, Tom, because we've got such an environment of conflict that's surrounded this issue for decades that, you know, these efforts, I think many people believe that, but when all the attention gets focused on, you know, almost a trench warfare style of, you know, focusing on the hydro system and how it should be operated, you know, all the energy and attention gets diverted from these other issues. You know, I like to say, and my trustees and members here in Montana say, you know, why are we eating our seed corn? Well, how does it make any sense to catch and eat an endangered species? We don't hardly talk about harvest issues and harvest impacts and what's the right level of harvest and what healthy stocks can be harvested and how do you stop, you know, harvesting on the most imperiled stocks.
Well,
we don't even get to that discussion because of all this energy diverted towards this hydro system litigation.
Understood. I want to get to like salmon wars versus timber wars, but going back into that litigation thing. Well, let's just, before I run out of time, let's go. I'm speaking with a gentleman very involved in the timber industry, and you may know him, Bruce Vincent, up there in northwestern Montana, had him talk about a few years ago the timber wars. And the industry Well, one in particular, you know, his industry learned an awful lot, and they made some adjustments there. This whole thing has been sort of labeled the same thing of salmon wars, and it's the same thing, same kind of basic template. You have, environmentalism, and some would say, and you're making the case that, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but it's extreme environmentalism. It's over the top. Let's remove all the dams so we can have another 8 fish per acre or something like that. I'm exaggerating and making that up to make that point that it's the same sort of scenario playing out here. The salmon industry, how viable is that industry? And as you say, they don't come to the table, Joe, in the coast. That surprises me a little bit. I would think that they would have to come to the table if they're talking about the harvest and overall salmon numbers. And then again, it's sort of the same issue. But answer that question first, please, before I just continue to miss it.
Yeah, no, I think the harvest interests are certainly at the table. You know, in a sense, they have the same struggle in many ways that we do, whether it's tribes seeking, you know, commercial ceremonial subsistence harvest, whether it's commercial fishermen seeing dwindling runs. I mean, they're just as frustrated as we are. Mm. And so they're at the table. But what my point is that when the focus is entirely on a movement to breach 4 dams, even if that was wild, happened and it was wildly successful, it would still only impact, you know, 4 out of 13 listed stocks. And will do absolutely nothing for hundreds of other stocks at salmon stocks at low abundance.
Yeah.
So it's really this is such a misguided approach to scapegoat a single industry as being responsible for something that's a Pacific Coast wide problem. We just need people, I think, to take a step back from the fighting and litigating. And actually sit down and share ideas. And I think if we can get a community response to this issue and not a finger pointing scapegoating effort, we could make some progress because there's some pretty, well known other issues at play that just, like I said, it's not that that people don't come to the table. It's just that this kind of this dam breaching debate sucks all the oxygen out of the room.
Yeah, and people do need to step up, though, and work collaboratively for common outcomes. That's one of the same things that Bruce Benson had talked about on Monday. Salmon wars, timber wars, they're not unlike each other. We're going to be back with more of Joe Lucas here in just a bit on Voices of Montana. Continuing conflict over how much water in the Columbia River Basin, essentially, because they're looking at reservoirs. And one of the things that perhaps this new motion would do as the state of Oregon is working outside its Columbia Basin Collaborative and possibly, moving an issue forward without full consideration. We are speaking with Joe Lucas here, general manager of Western Montana Generation and Transmission Cooperative on this issue and how it affects Montana. It does go back to many years when there have been efforts to remove the Columbia River dams. We've talked about that in environmental ways. But let's move over to energy, Joe, as we have just enough time. How much power would removing 4 dams take off of the grid and even more? They're not going to stop at 4. And will that lead to, we're concerned about blackouts nowadays.
Going to dam removal. So we saw the 3,000 megawatts of capacity from just the 4 lower Snake dams, which get talked about the most, that would definitely dramatically increase blackout risk. Even without dam breaching, this proposal or this injunction request of the federal district court would reduce power generation enough to increase blackout risk. And during the heat wave in June, we saw blackouts in Spokane, and we narrowly avoided blackouts in the Tri-Cities. And the only reason we did that is because we had the flexibility of the hydro system and the lower Snake River dams. That's the only reason. And those blackouts could affect us here in Montana. It's not just a Washington issue or Oregon issue. It's kind of a Northwest-wide issue because
Bonneville Power Administration and those dams serve so many people, serve over 130,000 co-op members here in Montana, that even small reductions in the output of those projects could dramatically increase the risk of blackouts or put us, you know, over the edge to where it's forced to, you know, to protect the power grid, not unlike what we saw in Texas back over the winter. So, you know, we're on a, with the retirement of coal plants, with the need to integrate, you know, wind and solar projects, we're on a razor's edge as far as having enough of what we call dispatchable power generation. That is power that can be controlled, you know, by a person and not controlled by, you know, weather systems, which is what happens with so many renewables. So we're at a razor's edge of not, you know, of being able to avoid blackouts.
I believe that. Just looking at all the numbers and all the issues surrounding that, it's something we'll have to circle back on. Joe Lucas, thank you so much for being here. Should give that title again, General Manager of the Western Montana Generation and Transmission Cooperative. Really good job today, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for the opportunity to share this story.
All right, we'll see you all tomorrow, huh?